pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. We're up to episode 18. Scott's with me. How are you, Scott?
I'm very well, thanks, Trevor. And yourself?
Very well. We've got the Secular Party AGM under our belt for this week, Scott.
So we did. It was a good turnout too, actually.
It was. And congratulations on your official appointment as the party treasurer.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that. Yeah.
So you're in charge of the millions that will be accumulating over the next little while.
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah. So, and yours truly is still has a position of spokesperson. So, and everybody else pretty much maintained the same jobs they had before. So there were no major ructions. Wasn't like the cat. Sometimes with these small organisations, you can get the most major fights, like the most the smaller and obscure the organisation, sometimes they just sort of get into terrible mischief. But we're pretty good at the moment, I think, Scott.
We have done very well indeed.
Yeah, I think everyone's on the same page, and there's no major rifts or anything, so that's good.
No, absolutely.
Because there's enough insaneness out there in the religious world that we don't need to add to it. Insanity, not insane, it's insanity in the religious world. So, so it's got various topics to talk about, and I think we'll follow up a little bit on the Human Rights Commission and the Religious Freedom Roundtable. So last week we discussed the sort of numbers of religious versus non-religious who seem to be invited and or were attending, and we've got a bit of an update on that. So,
well, we've got 44 religious people, and what was it, 4 people that weren't religious?
Let me find it exactly now. So having said all that, I've got it written on a piece of paper here because I got an email back. So I wrote to the Human Rights Commission on behalf of the Secular Party and said, how come we didn't get invited?
Yeah,
and well, I got a response, and what they said was that 17 religious organisations and 4 secular organisations will be attending. So, and of the 4 secular organisations, there will be, I believe, the rationalists, who we discussed last week for a fairly weak response on the issue. The Atheist Foundation, I think, the Secular Coalition of Australia, and the Humanists.
Right.
So they're going, and I don't know who the religious organisations are, but I suspect the usual suspects are in that group, Scott.
Well, you would think so, yeah.
Yeah, I'd imagine Catholics and all sorts of Christians, perhaps not Church of Scientology or some of the more obscure ones like that, but we'll see. But anyway, it was interesting. I said, you know, why weren't the Secular Party invited? And part of the email I got back was, we have adopted a policy that political parties and lobby groups will not be included.
Oh, for God's sake. I mean, that's just ridiculous because, you know, the religious groups that are going to be there are lobby groups anyway, aren't they?
Well, I would have thought, like, what's a lobby group? It's just a group of people with a similar ideas getting together as a group to make themselves a larger group to sort of have more power in their in their arguing. I would have fully expected someone like the Australian Christian Lobby to be invited and attend. Like, it wouldn't have surprised me, and it wouldn't have offended me. Like, I would have expected that group to be there.
You would have thought so, yeah.
And I mean, all these groups are lobby groups in a way. Like, the rationalists are a form of lobby group. The Secular Coalition of Australia is a form of lobby group. The Humanists, I mean, where do you draw the line as to what's a group and what's a lobby group?
It's crazy because you've got all the churches that are going to be represented there are lobby groups anyway. You know, they really are. It's there's no point trying to say that they're not.
Yeah.
So anyway. Yeah.
So I thought that was a really odd way of, you know, just I can handle no political parties. I can kind of see why that, but lobby groups anyway. But the interesting thing is, Scott, that our Vice President Ian Bryce is also, I think, President of the New South Wales Humanists. And
so he's now got an invite.
So he's going anyway. which is the thing about these things. Like, you can be part of all sorts of groups. And, yeah, so I'm sure that while he's there, he will be, no doubt, first and foremost, wearing the hat of the humanists. But where it doesn't conflict, and I can't imagine many areas where it does conflict, he'll be putting forward the views of the secular party in some way as well, I would have thought. So, yeah, a very strange sort of rule to bring out. But that's the religious roundtable that's coming up. So that was interesting.
Now, that's what date's that? That's in November sometime.
Yeah, early November, yeah. 5th or 7th or something like that. So okay. In Sydney. So
yeah.
So that was that. And then... did I mention last week that I would be meeting with Kate Jones, the Education Minister? I'm not sure.
You did, but it may well have been off air.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So several months ago, I happened to live in the electorate. Well, because I happened to live in the electorate of Kate Jones's electorate of Ashgrove, I was able to meet with her as a constituent and also wearing my hat as secular party spokesperson, which I warned her of beforehand, and had a meeting with her and her education advisor to discuss primarily the special religious instruction classes in Queensland schools. Scott?
How'd that go?
Quite well. So basically I said, obviously in the secular party, we don't like these instruction classes and we want them removed because we think it should be purely secular content in our state schools. And generally, what was her view? And her response was, well, she hasn't had any complaints. So it's not on her radar, was what she said. And
I've got to admit, I find that hard to believe. Yeah. She's had no complaints at all. But anyway.
You know, when I say no, you know, just a handful of letters, like nothing. So it just wasn't on the radar at all with people complaining. So I explained to her, well, in fact, people have voted, if you like, in writing in the way they've filled in the enrolment form when they've enrolled their children. Because in Queensland, listeners, it's an opt-in situation on the official enrolment form that if you want your child to attend religious instruction classes, you need to tick the box on the enrolment form to say what religion you are. If you leave it blank or you declare no religion, then the child is not supposed to go to SRI classes, unless you have some other written authority from the parents. So I explained to her that in most schools, the percentage of parents either leaving it blank or writing no religion in Queensland is somewhere around 70 to 75%. And she was completely astounded by that. She had absolutely no idea that that was the case. She said she would have thought it was the opposite.
Is that right?
She was very shocked by that. So so that was news to her and her advisor. What else did they say? That basically, as we were talking, she said the problem with the Newman government was that they didn't discuss things with stakeholders and they didn't tell the public what they were going to do. So she couldn't rock up to Parliament next week and change the law without first getting, you know, trying to at least persuade relevant stakeholders and putting it out there in the public. So basically she just left me with the job of contacting stakeholder groups like the PNC Association, the Principals Association and the Teachers Union. And if all those groups come on board to
say that they would like the course removed and replaced with something else, then she, I think, was fairly warm to the idea of actually changing it. So there's a job, Scott, for you and I and the Secular Party and anyone else who's interested, is A, we have to contact those associations and try and get them to agree to replace SRI with some sort of general religion and ethics class.
Yeah.
And B, we have to get people writing to Kate Jones and other members of Parliament saying that they're not happy with the current situation, because it seems to be how the politicians respond, is letters that they receive.
Well, that's rather odd, though, isn't it? I mean, considering, you know, how everything, you know, appears to be all social media driven, you'd think they'd be sort of concerned about that. But no, they appear to be still governed by how many people send an email through.
It is. So, yeah. You know, like there's a great group, I don't know if we mentioned before, Queensland Parents for Secular State Schools on Facebook.
Yep.
And, you know, they wouldn't be aware of them at all. They have no idea that they exist. So, so yeah, it's interesting on one level. We can do all these social media exercises, but, and, you know, write letters to the editor even, I suppose, all completely unnoticed until you actually write a letter addressed to a parliamentarian. So...
Mm.
So, listeners out there, if you are ready to join the Iron Fist Velvet Glove letter-writing team, please go on our website and send us a quick email, and we'll be in touch, because we'll have to generate, you know, email addresses for relevant politicians, and we'll do a bit of a mailing list and give you ideas of things to write and topics to write, and I think we need to generate this sort of things, got to get a team of people writing letters.
Well, I think that's probably the right thing to do, and then you write to your own constituent, and then you also copy in the education minister as well.
Yes, so perhaps the principal and your local member and the education minister as sort of all CC'd in, and that way we can start generating some awareness in our politicians about how no doubt everybody agrees with us on this, Scott. So so that's, I reckon that is a really good, you know, main objective for the Queensland branch of the Secular Party to achieve. Victoria's done it. They've shown us the way. This is the best thing that we could do in the short term, I reckon, that's achievable.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah.
So if you're out there listening and you're at all inclined with what we say, hop on the website and shoot us an email and we'll be in touch. So the other interesting part of all that, Scott, was I did mention to her that... I said, you know, back in 2006, the then Labor government tried to make this change. Are you aware of that? And she said, no, had no idea at all. Her advisor had no idea.
Good Lord.
And this was when Rob Welford was the education minister. And at the time, Julie Bishop was the federal education minister.
Yes.
And she was not happy with Queensland proposing to change religious indoctrination classes with some form of religious education and ethics classes. And I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but she basically was saying, well, we provide funding for schools, so we should have some say in what's taught. And she thought that widening the definition of what could be taught would allow cults and fringe groups like pagans and Wiccans to enter the school grounds and provide, you know, indoctrination on their beliefs. And
well, the funny thing is, I mean, did she not realise that pagans and Wiccans and other groups like that.
Yes.
Because they're already an organised religion, that they can get access to the kids' input.
That's right. Yes, that even today, at this very moment, pagans and Wiccans being recognised religious denominations could, in fact, start providing religious instruction and already. So,
very blinkered view of the world from Julie Bishop. So there's a link to her article, to the article where she says that, and it's a very young looking Julie Bishop, the photo of her as well. So I mentioned that, and of course Kate Jones and her advisor had no knowledge of that either. So it was very interesting that we can do all this podcasting and social media and talking, and yet the people who actually have the power have no knowledge of what we're talking about until we actually address them directly. So.
Yeah, it's madness.
Yeah. So, Scott, we have mentioned in the past that kids mixing together, Muhammad and Joel and Bill and and what a great de-radicalisation program that would be. We've said this. Well, we've got a link to an article where basically in Wales, the education minister has said exactly the same thing.
Exactly. And, you know, it was a very good article. I thoroughly enjoyed reading this one, and particularly on the, the third page. By the time you get down the printout, there's a picture of a Welsh class, and there's a girl there in the hijab.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's just there in a hijab, and that's it. Next to her is another girl that wasn't, and there's guys and all sorts of stuff sitting around the table as well.
Yep.
What's actually written in there, I think, is really very interesting too. The education minister told ITV News, this is an ITV program, the teaching the subject is titled Religion, Philosophy and Ethics would equip young people here with a level of knowledge and understanding which means they would not be vulnerable to extremists. You know, surely that's the sort of thing that we've got to be trying to get away from. I mean, what we have seen is how difficult it is to de-radicalise someone. So we're going to be able to get to a situation where we can stop them being radicalised in the first place, I would have thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And a program like that, that is aimed at having religion, philosophy and ethics all discussed under one topic, under one banner, I think that's a great way to go. So, yeah. Top marks to the Welsh for having to go down that way.
Yeah, basically saying along the lines of knowledge is power, and that with full knowledge, then these children are not vulnerable to people who might want to manipulate them because the children can think for themselves.
Exactly.
And that is just plain old common sense. That
well, one would have thought so, yeah.
Yeah, so... And this actually came up in the discussion with Kate Jones, actually, because talking about all these issues, and there was a bit of a joke made about, you know, would it fit in with de-radicalisation, and a bit of a ha-ha. And I stopped and I said, actually, this is exactly what we're saying. It would actually be the best de-radicalisation program you could possibly do, in all seriousness. Mm. So it did come up that they were sort of looking at de-radicalisation programs, and I had to sort of stop and say, well, in all seriousness, this is the ultimate de-radicalisation program. Incidentally, still going back to that, now that I think about it, there was a couple of other things. I said, are you at all interested in regulating prayer groups in schools? And she said no.
Yeah, she doesn't even know what's happening in New South Wales, huh?
I said, you don't think that's a little bit dangerous? And her and her advisor sort of looked at me and said that they basically want to leave that up to the school principals to decide on a case-by-case basis about prayer meetings. So that was that.
Yeah.
And the other thing I raised briefly was... I didn't raise school chaplains, really, listeners, because that's a federal issue. There's nothing that a state sort of education minister can really do about that. But
They could actually walk away from the extra funding.
They're never going to do that.
No, so, I would imagine not.
No. They did. I did raise the issue of in religious schools, when hiring teachers, religious schools can refuse to hire a teacher because they're not of the correct religion, and asked whether they were interested in changing that. And again, were not interested and actually weren't even sure whether it was a state act or not, which it is. So, yeah. So that's not even on the agenda either. So, so that was a diversion back to that topic while I thought of it. So,
No, you're right. Yeah, just on that final thing about the Welsh thing was the Henna Foundation, a charity who works with Welsh Muslim families, said, and this is a direct quote, "We need to develop safe spaces for young people to discuss what's happening in the world today. And classrooms should be able to provide that safe space for those conversations to happen." Well, I mean, that's a very good point. And you would think that a classroom should be entirely safe and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
Yep. We previously mentioned abortion, and I came across an article, Scott, because I said at the time, look, it looks to me that like abortion is still illegal in Queensland. I wasn't real sure.
It is.
And, yeah, we've come across an article, and do you want to give the... Have you got that in front of you?
Oh, I do have that in front of me. It's from the Brisbane Times, which is from the Fairfax stable. Where do we go with that? Abortion is against the law in Queensland unless it can be proven that a woman's physical and or mental health is serious danger if the pregnancy were to proceed. Abortion is also illegal in New South Wales, but legal to 24 weeks in Victoria, 16 weeks in Tasmania, 20 weeks in Western Australia, and legal to 14 weeks in Northern Territory. The crux of the article, Fist, is that you've got a situation where they have said that the outdated Queensland abortion laws are creating a tourism for women travelling south to have terminations performed by competent legal practitioners.
Yeah.
Which is really disturbing, actually. I had no idea that a termination was not legal up here in Queensland or even New South Wales. I was very surprised to find that out.
Neither did I. I'm quite surprised as well. But it seems to be one of these things that we're just... The authorities are turning a blind eye to probably a lot of the time.
Well, that's what it appears to be, yeah. Mm. Yeah, which is really disturbing. Mm. You know, where are we? Professor DaCosta said there's early testing of fetal abnormality could create more acceptable and less risky environment for women to go and get an abortion should they so desire. I find it somewhat disturbing that a termination is still illegal. Anyway, what did you want to say about it?
Well, I think it's... Well, see, in Queensland, we've got Anastasia Palaszczuk, female premier.
Yeah.
She's really sort of been accused of doing nothing so far. And, you know, well, this is an issue where she probably will get away with it because the conservative liberal opposition are not going to be pushing for abortion law reform anytime soon.
No, they're not.
And she'll probably avoid it because she thinks, well, why have a fight if I don't need one? But this is the sort of thing that a Labor government should be doing.
Well, one would have thought so, yeah.
A law that harks back to 1899, this should be the sort of thing that a Labor Attorney General tidies up and would be wanting to do, but... people don't seem to have the ideological sort of fervour that they used to have. And rather than getting in and changing things, they just want to avoid fights. So,
yeah, which is really disturbing because you'd think that you'd have, if you'd actually gone into politics, you'd be a fighter yourself because you have to fight to get there in the first place.
Yeah.
And then to sort of walk away from the fight because it gets hard or what have you, I mean... it's just bizarre.
So I think that's one we might try and agitate on as a secular party. Well, why not? I reckon there's a law that needs changing, so we'll put a bit of pressure on.
Needs changing, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, we'll apply what pressure we can and we'll see where it goes from there.
Mm. So Pope and the Vatican, Scott, letting us down again. Well... No, they're not letting us down.
Are
that would
really that surprised.
That would assume that they'd pumped us up. But
I mean, the Catholic Church has decided, this is from the Pink News, and there'll be a link to that on the website too. The Catholic Church will make no concessions for LGBT people in the church as the family synod concludes in Rome.
Mm.
Well, I don't know what a lot of us were expecting. I think the problem is the current Pope, Pope Francis, has been saying stuff that you think, wow, this bloke's actually a decent guy and that sort of stuff. But then when it comes to actually trying to get him to do anything, you find out that it's a little bit hard to shift something that's a couple of thousand years old. The Catholic Synod on the Roman Catholic Family is closing this weekend, or has closed. When was this printed?
I think it's closed.
It's closed. So, yeah, it's definitely closed anyway. It has closed, and from that...
nothing's changed.
Essentially, that's exactly right. Nothing has changed, yeah. I mean, essentially, at the end of the day, you've got a situation that they're not going to recognise same-sex families and that sort of stuff. The thing that the takeaway I took from it was they really don't understand this difference between a... where is it? Well, they don't understand that there's this difference between a state-sanctioned marriage and a church marriage.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing that I found incredibly disturbing.
Mm.
Where it said, here it is, the language describing same-sex marriage, not even remotely analogous to heterosexual marriage, marked a clear victory for the conservative camp who continue to argue that homosexuality is a sin. Well, you know, it's just, it's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, it was agreed that homosexuals should not be discriminated against, but said there was absolutely no grounds for gay marriage. Well, yeah, okay, fair enough. You know, I suppose I can file this under the thing that I usually file it under, from pronouncements from the Vatican, and thinking to myself, well, that's something that's very interesting for someone who's a couple of, who's interested in a book that was written a couple of thousand years ago, and move on.
Yeah, but, I mean, to me, it's just this classic case of the Pope talking a good game, but then not performing at all. So,
well, that's exactly it.
You know, he described the summit as a way to open up broader horizons, rising above conspiracy theories and blinkered viewpoints, and further on, but rather about seeing these difficulties and uncertainties in the light of the faith, carefully studying them and confronting them fearlessly, without burying our heads in the sand. So these are all, you know, wishes and comments of the Pope. Meanwhile, at the end of it, they just simply say, same-sex marriage, not even remotely going to happen. And absolutely no grounds for gay marriage. So file that under the this Pope is all talk and no action, and so no different to anybody else.
Well, I think that is the problem, is that he certainly does appear to be all talk, no action.
Yeah.
And that's a real pity for him, because he certainly the talk that he's been making has been fine. You know, I mean, what he's actually been saying has been great, but what he's actually been doing has been two-thirds bugger all.
Yeah, yep. So, now, Scott, I wasn't able to bring up this link again, but I just came across an article in relation to Tony Abbott. Actually, my son texted me a message because, you know, Tony Abbott came out with some statements about how Europe should follow the example he set in Australia,
us stopping the boats it'll work for you.
So my son said, something like, you know, Abbott, you'll no doubt talk about that, and we'd previously described him as the gift that keeps giving,
even though he's no longer in office, he certainly continues to keep giving.
He's still giving. He's still doing it, but at least it's not as exasperating now, because he doesn't have the power that he had before, so...
Well, that's it, yes.
So it's a relief that he can say these things, and it doesn't churn the stomach like it used to. So there was actually an article I've got a link to, and the website for the ABC is currently down, so it's not showing it, but... Essentially, it was saying that Australians are in a post-traumatic moment. Like, having suffered with Tony Abbott for so long and some pretty poor choices before him, we've emerged from that with Malcolm Turnbull, and his ratings are so high because we've been so battered by the trauma of Tony Abbott. And I think it's right.
Well, I think it is bang on the money. Yeah. I mean, I do. You know, unfortunately, politicians are at their best in their valedictory speeches.
Mm.
And you know, Joe Hockey, yeah, he was an idiot for Treasurer and that sort of stuff for sure. But when he was actually talking the way he was speaking in his valedictory speech, you had to sit there and listen to him and think, wow, this guy actually knows what he's talking about. Where he said, I hope. And he's, you know, where he said that he hopes that everything's fine for the Turnbull government, that the Turnbull government lasts for a long time and so on and so forth. But, and this is the but that I'm put in there, is I fear that the public will get sick of him at some point soon.
Yeah.
You know, and I hope that that some point soon is sort of two terms along.
Mm.
And that sometime through his third term, he decides to stand down and hand over, presumably to Morrison, would be one suggestion.
Malcolm Turnbull stands down in favour of Scott Morrison?
No, I'm not hoping that Scott Morrison takes the job, but, you know, Morrison's, you know, they're calling him ScoMo. He's the next big thing for the Conservative right of the Liberal Party. And, you know, the moderates are in charge now, so the next turn will have to be going back to the Conservative right again.
I hope not.
No, it doesn't have to. Of course not. It doesn't have to. I mean, like, let's face it, you know, the thing about... the reason why... oh, God, what was his name? Isn't that terrible? The bloke who was the longest-serving treasurer under the Howard government.
Costello.
Costello. Mm. The reason why Costello never got anywhere is because he never had any backing within the party.
Right.
You know, the party himself never backed him.
Yes.
Howard, to his very great credit, managed to reinvent himself. He went from being the man that described himself as the most conservative Liberal Party leader the party's ever had, and moved on to become, you know, looking back on him now, as a man of complete sort of, yeah, looks like a real, not lefty, but a genuinely liberal person. Anyway.
Except in relation to education.
Yeah, absolutely.
And bombing people.
Yeah, okay. And bombing people
allowing vote people in.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
So, and the environment and Aboriginal affairs.
Yeah, well, like I said, he just looked like one, that's all.
He's very clever at masking his extremism, I think, and painting it. He's very good at painting it as an attractive way to the Howard battlers, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Mm. You know, he was certainly was. And then when you look here, it says... you know, let's go through the article. Many on the left despair, wondering why there are so few fundamentals of policy have changed. People are suddenly giving their polling support and what is still essentially the party about it.
Mm.
Oh dear, they mourn. Are people that blind? Well, you know, maybe they are. Maybe people are blinded. That the fact is, it's true. Not a lot's changed.
Mm.
You know, very little has changed. We've still got a budget that's got measures that are locked up in the Senate and that sort of stuff that are pretty awful.
Yep. So, you know, in many ways, Malcolm Turnbull and Pope Francis have got a lot in common in the sense that theoretically they're in charge and can make decisions, but there's all these powers that they have to deal with, and they've got to marshal the troops, and it's not as easy as it perhaps seems.
Oh, that's exactly right, and that is the real problem. And Turnbull can't be just it can't be all just Turnbull's way. He's got to look at he's got to look after the entire party there.
Mm.
And unfortunately, for whatever reason, you've got a majority of the people that are down in Parliament are from the Conservative right of the party.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it goes further on. Where are we? The bottom line is this. Malcolm Turnbull is riding the tidal wave of relief that is washing across the country at this stage. The polls are showing nothing more than the fact that he isn't Tony Abbott. For things to really improve, we're going to need a more fundamental change than that. And that's bang on the money. We are going to have to see what he actually does.
Yeah.
And this is the first bit of analysis that I've read, actually, which suggests that 53-47, which is what the latest Fairfax Ipsos poll has got things at, is not going to be permanent.
Right.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, there's always a honeymoon, so just how long you can keep it going. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Now...
But yeah, it's a very interesting one.
Another one we come across is in the UN... an article about children's right to freedom of religion, and
yeah,
there was
very interesting, wasn't it?
A UN expert who is described as a special rapporteur. So he's given a report on religious freedom. There's that adjective. Is it an adjective? Freedom going with religion. Scott, that we talked about, the two going hand in hand quite a lot recently, and and he has said in relation to children and parents, he said that parents are not obliged to provide a religiously neutral upbringing in the name of the children's right to an open future. The rights of parents to freedom of religion or belief includes their rights to educate their children according to their own conviction and to introduce their children to religious initiation rites. It's tricky, isn't it, Scott? Like, children aren't property. You know,
No, they're not. But, you know, it's one of those things... don't know where I stand on this. I mean, because surely you don't want children just to be, to be indoctrinated with something and then come up later on in life and then think to myself, well, why the hell did I do that? Which is essentially what a lot of your religions actually end up doing, is they grab you early and then they got you for life.
See, you know, on the one hand, if you said to people, we want to stop parents indoctrinating children into Scientology, people would go, yeah, good idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they see it as obviously evil and stupid. And if you said, well, we want to stop people, you know, indoctrinating their children into Catholicism, they would say, well, hang on, that's the freedom of the parents to do that. So
yeah,
we've got to work on that perception of religion. You know, the rights of parents over children is, it's not total. And we draw lines at certain points and say, well, you know, they're not your property. You can't do what you like with your children. You can't sexually abuse them, for example. So we stop when it comes to abuse and say, well, you just can't do that. It doesn't matter that you're a parent. So it really, somebody as extreme as myself, Scott, would look at indoctrination as a form of abuse, yet other people don't see it as that. So it's a tricky one.
I'm not sure how tricky it is. I mean, like, surely if you have we're going back to it, you know, favorite hobby horse, yes, education. Surely if you come back to having a decent education system that is grounded outside of state, that is in state provided schools, so on and so forth, with a secular curriculum, then it doesn't really matter what you get taught on a Sunday, because you're going to be more inclined just to say, well, bugger it, this is what I truly believe.
Yeah. See, what he's saying, well, let's take it on state schools and religious schools. So we can safely say in a publicly funded school, we as a society can say that we want a secular curriculum with no religious instruction and do your religion in your own time.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a situation of a school that's wholly privately funded with no government money, can we in that school say, you know what, as part of the education curriculum, like we decide kids have to be taught maths and English, etc. We're also deciding you have to teach general religious education. I think we could.
I think we could, yeah.
Could we also then say, and you cannot teach indoctrination? You cannot indoctrinate? That's where it gets a bit hairy.
I think you could actually go with that and say you couldn't indoctrinate.
Yeah. Yeah, and do that outside of school hours, even in a wholly privately funded school, of which don't know of too many.
Well, you don't know of too many because there's just the whole thing's been made so easy for them to get money from the federal government.
Yeah. So, see, I look at it in terms of, you know, we've got these, the Saudis provide money for the madrasas, which are schools which are teaching Wahhabism to young people, and they've got the money to wholly fund these things. They're currently getting government money, but with, you know, the secular party ever gets any power, we would be saying you're not going to get any money if you're going to teach Wahhabism to children in school. They could at that point say, well, okay, we won't take your money, but we're still going to teach it. And then we're going to have to deal with this issue then. So we've got a little bit of thinking time before we get to that, Scott. But that's... anyway, this human rights expert from the UN would, having read his report, say, well, that would be fair enough in that situation for the school to do that. So not sure I agree with him. And hopefully at some stage we'll have to actually confront that decision. But not in the near future anyway.
Well, I mean, yeah, look, I'd be inclined to go with it and say, well, you know, if they're not going to comply with the curriculum that's been set down by the government, then, yeah, bugger them. You know, not only did they not get any revenue from the taxpayer, they also, the graduates of their school can't go into university.
Yeah,
you know,
yep.
It's as simple as that.
So, now, Scott, I sent this to you very late. It wasn't in the first ones I sent to you, but there was an article from the Daily Telegraph.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
So you did get to see it. So
I did, yes.
So the title, listeners, is Fury as Muslim Students Allowed to Walk Out of Assembly During the National Anthem. Now, this is in Australia, Cranbourne Carlisle Primary School, and the principal said she was allowing Shia children to opt out of singing or listening to the anthem because it was a religious month of mourning and they should not be forced to take part in joyous events. Good Lord!
I mean, this is just out of control, isn't it? It really is just... This is just silly. Now, I mean, to say that... To say that the national anthem is a joyous sounding song and that sort of stuff, and therefore kids shouldn't have to be involved in it because they're in a religious month of mourning, it's just nonsense.
Yes.
It really is nonsense.
Yeah. So prior to last week's Years 2-6 assembly, students were given the opportunity to leave the hall before music was played.
Yeah.
And with that, about 30 or 40 children got up and left the room. They sang the national... The remaining ones sang the national anthem and the others came back in. Like, good... In Australia, in 2015.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. It really is crazy.
So,
And look, this is not a religious school either. It's a bloody state government school.
It is, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's ridiculous.
So, anyway, that's what's going on at schools at some stage. So... Boy, that's an interesting one.
Well, yeah, it is, and it's just crazy.
Yep.
You know, it clearly is wrong.
Yep. Yeah. Scott, did you get a chance to look at the superannuation one?
Yes, I did.
What do you think?
I did look at that one. Well, look, I mean, I think it's actually a well and truly long time overdue, actually, superannuation.
So you better tell people what currently happens with superannuation and what did this propose?
Currently what happens is that you get taxed at 15 cents in the dollar on your superannuation contributions. So it doesn't matter how much you earn.
someone like me that should be paying 40, 45 cents in the dollar, I end up paying 15 cents on the dollar for any contributions that go into superannuation on my behalf. So there's a 30 cent gain for me to put money into superannuation. Now, what's actually come back is probably where the government will end up going, because we've got a situation where no one wants to go as far as what really should happen. That is that you should say, well, you should just treat everything just as income and be done with it, and tax it and so on and so forth. What we're getting to now is that we've got a situation, and I think it was Deloitte's came up with Deloitte's Access. Deloitte's came up with a situation where they would say that for those of you earning $180,000 a year or more, you would pay 30 cents in the dollar on your super contributions. What they're saying is that you would get a 15% tax deduction.
Yeah, discount. On that. Yes, a discount. Off what your normal marginal rate is. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that was really very interesting, because then you got people who do, you know, earn, I don't know what that rate would be, probably about 40 grand a year, where you pay sort of 19 cents in the dollar. With that 15% discount, they'd end up paying 4 cents in the dollar on their contributions. So it was actually a really interesting idea. It's got a little while to go yet, but we'll go right back to the beginning here. It says, Treasury says that it cost $36 billion this financial year in lost tax revenue. Deloitte say the figure is closer to $11 billion. Well, it's somewhere between the two. Excuse me. If you've got a situation like that, you know, where it's costing between $11 billion and $36 billion, you've got a hell of a lot of money there that's really got to be found. Now, what I found really disturbing was that only $1 in every $200 of the cost of superannuation concession goes to the bottom 20% of income earners. Now, that's a phenomenal bloody amount of money.
What was that? Say that again.
The only $1 in every $200 of the cost of superannuation concessions goes to the bottom 20% of income earners.
Go on. One in 200.
Yeah. So that's less than 1%.
It just does seem to be overall weighed far too heavily in favour of the rich, and it's imbalanced that way. So
absolutely it is. It's way too heavily favoured towards the wealthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure.
And
so, go on.
In particular, in the way that in your latter years, sort of in your 50s and 60s, if you're doing quite well, you can pour enormous amounts of money into super and squirrel away in there, and then not long afterwards in your retirement, you know, access it. And, you know, the whole notion of superannuation originally was, we want you to put money aside so that we don't have to fund so much pension in latter years, and as a reward for not touching it for those 30 years, we'll provide you with tax concessions. But the way it's often used is really in the years leading up, you know, in the 10 years prior to anticipated retirement, people pour all sorts of money into it and then have considerable advantages that often the average Joe Blow just can't do. So
yeah, exactly. And that's what's really wrong, is it? And you're right, because the big lot comes in later when you actually retire yourself.
Yeah.
And again, that was Howard's plan. That's fine. That was Howard and Costello brought that in. But no, I've lost it. I didn't mark it. But there was a point there that actually talked about that particular tranche of it, which said that you got this money out of your superannuation tax free.
Yes.
Which I found bizarre.
Yeah.
Anyway, but look, this is a very good proposal. Well, we'll see whether or not it gets up. But
I thought it was a good one. Scott, and the other thing was, if you are earning under $18,000, you're not paying any tax.
Yeah.
So before, when the money went in, you were getting taxed at 15% for your money in super, whereas normally you don't pay any. And so under this proposal, you would actually get a 15% bonus somehow would be credited to you if you were in that category and put and money went into super, which I thought was a great idea. So, so yeah,
absolutely.
So that seemed a fair thing.
Well, I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
And Scott, I sent you another late one, which I don't know if you saw, about Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz.
Yes, and I haven't finished reading it, but yeah, go
so
on.
I was stumbling around looking at the TV the other night, and I just came across this Late Line episode where Tony Jones interviewed Sam Harris, well-known atheist secularist, and a fellow called Majid Nawaz, who is a former Islam extremist turned moderate, basically discussing the problems with Islam and jihad and Islamism and extremism. And got a link to that one on the website and loved everything both of these guys had to say. And previously I've said that there's, you know, things in the Quran that just go way further than what goes on in the Bible, and that's one of the difficulties with Islam. And they sort of touched on that in some way to say that, you know, is there something in the nature of Islam as opposed to other religions that gives rise to this particular brand of brutality? That was the question from Tony Jones. And Sam Harris said that Christianity, Islam has not had a collision with modernity, secularism and science in the way that Christianity has. So perhaps that's what it's having right now, but it hasn't had that clash that has knocked the crazy edges off it that Christianity has. But the really great quote, and I know I'm going to use this forever now, was by Sam Harris, and they were talking about ISIS. Yeah. And he made this, he was talking about the origins of the religions and stuff, and he said, you have to ask yourself, what is ISIS doing that Muhammad didn't do or wouldn't have approved of? Because Muhammad was not a hippie who got crucified. He wasn't a meditator who sat cross-legged under a Buddha tree. He was a warlord who did many of the things that you see members of ISIS doing. And that is so true that when people say it's a religion of peace and that this is totally out of character with Islam, I mean, the guy who started it, he would have done all these things.
Exactly.
He didn't. He would have done it all, except he didn't post it on Facebook because they didn't have it then. But he would have if he could have.
He didn't have a Facebook. Yeah, agreed.
So that is a really good line, I thought, was, what are they doing that Muhammad didn't do or wouldn't have approved of?
And what was Majid Nawaz's response?
The two of them are in agreement on many things. So he was saying that Islam needs reform, and that that Muslims are reluctant to do it, and they shouldn't be, that they need to. So he was quite critical. You know, he was saying that you can have a peaceful observance of the faith, but that essentially the scripture has to be rewritten or reinterpreted. So and that Muslims have to face up to this and do it. So fantastic.
Absolutely.
And the other interesting sort of argument that was in there was about this sort of sincere belief in paradise that Islam has, as well as Christianity for that matter. And he was talking about some Taliban attack where they killed 132 children, and that the Taliban were not remorseful at all, because under their belief system, you can't kill the wrong person. So if it's an infidel and you've killed the infidel, well, that's good. And if it was a believer who you've killed, then that person is a martyr and is going to paradise. So that's good as well. So So whatever somebody's beliefs are, that if you've got this belief in paradise for the good, then you could just go around killing anybody and it's all okay because the good end up in paradise and the bad were, well, they've just been killed, which is what you're supposed to be doing. Very, very interesting argument.
Well, it's a very interesting argument, yeah.
It's a, you know, it's a bit like the one we discussed, you know, when I think you were 20% responsible for the death of Jesus and Jews were responsible as well. But at the end of the day, you know, the whole ideology required Christ to die in order to cleanse us of original sin. So it actually, killing Jesus was a good thing. So it's a similar sort of argument in that a killing couldn't be wrong.
Well, that's it. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
It's the sort of mental gymnastics that happen with this sort of thing. So, and they also have a bit of a rant about the liberal left and censorship and saying that it's a cul-de-sac ethically and politically. We have to treat the Muslim community worldwide as adults who have to tolerate satire and have to tolerate free speech and have to tolerate pluralism and human rights. So there were heaps of great quotes in that that were fantastic. You can find that link and watch it. It was a really good one.
Absolutely.
So, Scott, I reckon that that's getting us close to the 60 minutes, and we both have been... Well, I've got an engagement to go to, so we might be signing off a fraction early, but and next week, folks, not sure if one will be produced or not.
One will be produced.
Because I'm, believe it or not, folks, away on another holiday.
You're going on a holiday again?
Yes, relative getting married, and we're away for that, so... So I'll be out of action, and so Scott, good luck. Hope you can put one together, and listeners, look out for that one, and you'll hear from me in a couple of weeks and maybe from Scott in a week, but until then, it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Bye, everyone. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.